It's time again for another episode of CMO Convo, and that means it's time again for another conversation on the important things CMOs need to know. Today, we're joined by Mike Shapoka, CMO of Channel Advisor, and he's sharing his insights on the state of e-commerce and the role data plays in marketing strategies, both now and in the future. Hi, Mike. Welcome to CMO Convo. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you, Will?
I'm good. Yeah, definitely. And I'm very excited about this conversation as well, because it's one that's going to be very, very relevant to a lot of CMOs, both in B2B and B2C. E-commerce, it's been a major part of marketing and business for a while now, but I think the pandemic has caused it to absolutely explode in terms of usage, in terms of the requirements put on it. But before we do get down into talking about e-commerce, maybe you could introduce yourself, Mike. Tell us a bit about yourself and tell us a bit about Channel Advisor as well.
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Mike Shapoker. I'm the CMO of Channel Advisor. Channel Advisor is a leading provider of software as a service based e-commerce solutions. So we have a multi-channel commerce platform that helps our customers streamline their e-commerce operations and really focused on channels such as marketplaces and dropship and advertising, shoppable media. And we help them expand to new channels and really optimize performance on those channels. So that's Channel Advisor in a nutshell. My background, I have probably a little bit of an odd background for a CMO. I started my life in electrical engineering at university. I came out and was doing some of that in consulting. I went back and got a business degree. I ended up doing product marketing for a while. Then I've done account management, so working with some of our large customers at Channel Advisor, managed services. I ran our business operations team, product management, helped out with some acquisitions. I had some international experience over in London. And now I'm the CMO. So I'm probably a jack of all trades, master of none, maybe not necessarily the recommended path for a CMO, but nevertheless, that's my journey so far.
It's a very, very diverse background in terms of everything you covered. Do you think that's given you a certain outlook in how you approach CMO, being a CMO, in terms of like how you deal with all the different stakeholders within your organization?
I think so. I think it gives me an appreciation for other teams and, you know, maybe the struggles they're going through, and you know, if something's not working right on the operations side, I remember back to my time on that team, and I can maybe feel a little bit more sympathy for them than I should. But yeah, so I think it's given me a broad perspective on marketing now.
And having that broad perspective has got to be very important when it comes to e-commerce, because it requires so many different departments being involved. Is that kind of diverse background giving you a better perspective on how to leverage e-commerce for organizations?
I think so. I think, you know, the one thing, and I don't claim to be an expert on anything, but I think one thing that's really helped is my time early on at Channel Advisor. I was working directly with our customers. So working directly with them to help them sell on marketplaces. And at the time when I was doing it, it was mostly eBay. It was when, you know, Amazon Marketplace hadn't, you know, really rose to the prominence it is today. And then, you know, I was helping our, you know, customers advertise on Google. You know, I've actually worked kind of down in the trenches with our customers. And again, this was a long time ago, so a lot has changed since then. It's a lot more complicated now than it used to be when I was doing it. But I think that background still helps me a lot, you know, when we're targeting customers and you know, what's the messaging and how can we help, you know, Fantastic. With our marketing efforts, how can we help them?
Fantastic. Speaking of a lot of things have changed, a lot of things have changed in a very short amount of time recently with e-commerce. The amount of consumers who have switched to using e-commerce as their main source of doing any kind of shopping or retail, the number of B2B organizations that have had to switch over to e-commerce models has increased massively as well. Is this something that's likely to continue beyond the pandemic, or is this just a flash in the pandemic? I'm trying to coin that as a phrase. I haven't heard it used anywhere else
like
yet.
But
yeah,
like
I'm throwing
that.
It around a lot. But yeah, are people going to stick with like e-commerce as their main source of any kind of retail, or are they going to go back to stores in like the same numbers that they were prior to the pandemic?
Yeah, so I think the answer is a little bit of both. But let me start, you know, by saying, you know, as we all experienced in the early days of the pandemic, many economies just shut down. So non-essential brick and mortar stores were just shut. And if you look at all the government data from, you know, Q2 2020, Q3 2020, e-commerce sales spiked. And at the time, that led a lot of, you know, pundits and experts to say that e-commerce growth, which had really been just ticking up steadily year by year, just slowly gaining share, slow but steady. But anyway, at the time when the pandemic first shut everything down, the pundits started saying, hey, e-commerce has been pulled forward 10 years or 5 years or 100 years. I mean, there was outrageous claims being made. As we've started to get back to normal, I think it's clear that a lot of those early predictions were maybe a bit exuberant. So, you know, exaggerated. But there's no doubt that the pandemic created for many people, many organizations, new experiences that they may not otherwise have had, you know, without the pandemic. So just to give an example, we did consumer surveys globally last year, you know, toward the latter part of last year. And we had done this a couple times throughout the pandemic, but in the most recent surveys, 50% of respondents indicated they were shopping online more since the pandemic. And 45% said it was about the same. So 95% were either the same or more. And it's actually a little bit higher in the UK there. The second questioner, the next question asked about future expectations, and 42% globally thought that they would shop online more than before the pandemic. So another 55% said nothing would change, you know, really from that point. So that's 97% of either we're going to do the same or more since the pandemic. And then, you know, just taking it, so surveys are great, but taking it down to a personal level, I use grocery delivery and click and collect for grocery for the first time in the US when the pandemic, you know, was at its, you know, when everything was shut down. When I lived in London for a few years, I previously used a grocery delivery service, and that experience was great. But in the US, it's, you know, it's pretty easy to hop in your car and just, you know, drive to the store. So I hadn't really done it here. But once the pandemic hit, I started doing it. And, you know, now I'm back in stores, but I still do use that click and collect every now and then when I can get my act together and get a list long enough to, you know, to go, you know, go pick it up. So that's just a personal example of something I hadn't tried. The pandemic got me to try it, and I'm going to keep doing it. Maybe not as much as I did for those, you know, couple months during the peak of the pandemic, but I'll keep doing it going forward. And so I think overall, this experience is probably the same for everybody. And so e-commerce is going to be lifted maybe just a little bit above and beyond the normal tick up that we were seeing.
Yeah, so because it was already on the rise already. You mentioned the UK. There's been loads and loads of studies about how the British high street is dying, like the British retail sector is dying because of it being replaced by e-commerce. But then I think there is also going to be people who want to get out into the world. They want to go out and experience being in the stores again now. So maybe there will be more of a balanced approach in the future in the UK, at least. But that kind of leads me to what I wanted to talk about next. And then the expectations that people have for e-commerce now. You said like you tried something that you hadn't tried before during the pandemic. A lot of that is waking up to the convenience of something. Like it's so efficient. Well, we have so many expectations that e-commerce needs to be efficient. If it's for physical products, people want it delivered the next day or maybe even the same day if possible. If it's a digital product, they want a very, very smooth onboarding process. And that's the same in B2B and B2C. So are there any other major expectations that people have in terms of e-commerce beyond just convenience? So there are other things that people need, that CMOs need to be aware of when they're developing e-commerce experiences?
Yeah, I think one thing, it's maybe a slight twist on the question, but I think one thing that's important to point out about e-commerce is that you might get locked into the thinking that it just means that you're going to Amazon or you're going to your favorite online retailer to buy something and that's e-commerce. But really the discovery process and the buying journey is extremely diverse for consumers. Harvard Business Review had a study, it's several years old now, but it showed that 73% of consumers use multiple channels during their shopping journeys, and that's online channels and offline. And then Google had a similar study that had about the same percentage of consumers consider themselves channel agnostic. And so, you know, if you're trying to reach consumers, as a CMO of a brand or retailer or whatnot, you need to be in a lot of different places at once with your brand. And just, you know, going back to that survey, we actually asked consumers in the survey, in the past 12 months, how have you discovered the products that you've purchased online? And we, of course, we let them pick more than one. And I think the average was maybe three or more things that people picked. But when you look at the responses, the top responses were, I think 42% said they found, discovered products by browsing marketplaces. And so I think Amazon had a big impact there. 38% said browsing brand or retailer websites. 33% was word of mouth. So that makes sense. We're all, you know, talking to our friends. And 24% said social media, and it's slightly lower than that, social advertising. What's interesting there is when we picked it apart by demographics, we captured the demographics. And so as you might imagine, the younger generation, so people 25 years old and younger, sadly, I'm way past that. I'm more than double past that. But those demographics had much higher social media scores. And then, you know, Google search came up there for about 23%. And then 20% talked about ads on TV or streaming platforms. So, you know, as a CMO, you need your offerings or your products to show up wherever your target customers may be looking. And for, you know, to provide a great customer experience, the descriptions, the images, and how your brand is represented needs to be consistent across all of those channels. So that's really, you know, taking e-commerce and thinking about it from, it's not just maybe my own site. I need to think about wherever consumers may be looking for me. And then, as you mentioned, you know, the other expectations from the consumer's point of view are really, I think, you have been shaped over the last several years by Amazon. So you mentioned it, you know, people want to check out that's fast and easy. They want great customer service. They want fast and free shipping. And they want a relatively easy returns process if that has to be the case. And, you know, of course, not everybody can do what Amazon's doing with fulfillment in particular. Amazon's built out such a massive network of fulfillment infrastructure that nobody else is going to be able to do that. Is going to be able to take something and put it on my door, you know, in a day or in a couple of hours after I order it. But that, I think that's okay. As long as shipping times are reasonable and prices are reasonable, you know, different companies have different strengths. You know, it could be product expertise or category expertise, which, you know, Amazon's not really known for that. Zalando over there in Europe is really known for apparel. You know, that's their thing. And then, you know, you mentioned the high street and stores. The ability to pick up in a store is also, you know, Amazon's putting out there more and more stores. They bought, you know, Whole Foods in the U.S., but they don't have as broad of a network of stores maybe as some other retailers. So the ability to order and say, okay, well, I can't deliver it on your doorstep in 2 hours, but you can just kind of walk down the high street here and you can pick it up from me in 10 minutes. That's something, you know, that a lot of companies can leverage to really provide that, you know, a similar experience, you know, for that fast and free delivery.
Yeah, definitely. And when you talk about consumers using different channels as well, they expect it to be seamless how they switch between these channels now. Like if they're browsing on, say, if they're on TikTok looking at an influencer looking at the clothes they've got available there, if that influencer is advertising them for sale somewhere, they want to be able to click straight through from TikTok to be able to buy from there. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be having to re-enter information. They don't want to be logging into different accounts and stuff like that. They even want to be able to switch between devices. Like if you've got a checkout, if you've got a basket that's full that you've filled on your phone, if you switch to, say, your laptop, you want to see that basket still there. You don't have to go around and re-enter all your and do all your browsing and stuff again. So that's going to be incredibly difficult to manage, being able to make sure everything's aligned and everything's seamless between different experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right there. The less friction there is, the more chance you have of making a sale. And Amazon has reduced a lot of friction for consumers. And I think, you know, a lot of other companies are doing the same thing. But yeah, reducing that friction is key.
But yeah, and in order to reduce that friction, it requires, well, to tie this into the subject of the episode, it requires a lot of data. It requires being able to keep track of where all your consumers are, how they're switching between devices. So let's dive into the role of data in e-commerce, because obviously it does have a big function, but let's break it down. Like, what kinds of data are the most important when it comes to e-commerce?
Yeah, so, you know, e-commerce marketing is really all about data. And I mentioned customers using different channels, and the data you need for every channel may vary a little bit. You know, the specific data points you're paying attention to. But you know, at a super high level, there's the basic ingredients that apply in some way across every channel. And that is, you know, first of all, how many people are seeing your offers or your ads? Second, how much did it cost you to get in front of those people to gather that traffic or gather that audience? So the cost. And then, you know, the next thing is after that, what do those people do? So what are the conversion rates? What are the revenue you make from those people? And of course, those basic elements allow you to calculate a return on investment. So those are present in pretty much every channel. But then the next level down is the data points that can provide clues as to why your performance is what it is, or why your performance may not be as good as you want, or, you know, how do you compare to the competition? And, you know, I have some examples there I can go into. I'll just dive in there.
Let's do it.
Okay. Sounds good. So, you know, I think, you know, people who have e-commerce site, they're probably very familiar with their own site. So let me take a different tact and go into marketplaces, for example. So let's say you're selling on a marketplace. Again, you need to watch the basics, the revenue, all of the fees associated with those marketplaces, return rates by product, by marketplace. Basically, you need to make sure you're making money. You know, you don't want to do something and be losing money. So that's the obvious bits. I can make money. All right. So once you figure out you can make money, there are other metrics that matter a lot on marketplaces. And I'll use, you know, Amazon as an example, but a lot of marketplaces, you know, utilize some these metrics in one way, shape, or form. So, you know, where your product ranks in search results, that's a pretty key thing to pay attention to. Traffic to the product pages, you know, the number of units that are sold from those product pages. Again, that kind of gives you the conversion rate. But on Amazon, the unique thing is, they have a product page, but they have multiple sellers selling that same product. So they have the buy box. And most consumers, you know, you go to the page and you see the buy box over there and you click, you know, add to my cart or buy. And a lot of times you're not even paying attention to who's selling it. You know, you may see it sold by Amazon, or you may see it sold by such and such seller. So winning that buy box is super important for sales volume. If you're not in it, you're not going to sell a whole lot. If you're in it, you're probably going to sell a whole lot. And Amazon has algorithms that figure out who goes into that buy box. They don't publish it. They don't give away, you know, the keys to the kingdom, and other retailers don't do that either, because otherwise then people might game them. But the important factors, I think, for Amazon and probably a lot of other marketplaces include a lot of operational metrics. So Amazon, Zalando, Walmart, all of these companies want to provide consumers with a great experience. And so if you're a seller and you're not providing a great experience, they don't want to put you in that box and have people buy and then have a bad experience on their site. So there's a lot of operational metrics. And, you know, as a CMO, you may think, oh, that's my operations team that's in charge of those metrics. It's not me. I'm on the marketing metrics. But those operational metrics depend on whether you show up. So, you know, whether you're in marketing or finance or operations, if you care about your sales on Amazon or Zalando or any marketplace, you need to pay attention to these metrics. And there are things like, you know, I'll just read through the list, won't go through all the details, but obviously product availability. If you only have one of something left, you're probably not gonna be in the buy box because, you know, one sale and it's gone. Shipping methods. So as we know with Amazon, you know, Amazon Prime has an advantage. So if you're using their FBA program or Seller Fulfilled Prime or something else where you can be part of that Prime, that's an important aspect. Price, obviously a factor. All things equal, you know, if somebody's double the price, the lower price is going to end up in that buy box. Shipping times, you know, all things equal, the faster shipping times are going to end up there. And then you start getting to things like order defect rates, which really factors in buyer claims. So how many buyers, you know, have some kind of problem, negative feedback, and chargebacks. And so I think order defect rates need to be, you know, less than 1%, probably a lot less than that, in order to, you know, have your best chance of being in that buy box. There's fulfillment related metrics, such as, you know, are you providing tracking information? Were the orders shipped later than the expected ship date? What percentage of orders are delivered on time? All of those fulfillment related metrics. Of course, there's seller feedback scores. So if you, you know, make a lot of customers angry and they give you bad feedback, you know, it's going to hurt your chance of being in that buy box. How fast you respond to customer inquiries and questions. Inventory depth, meaning, you don't have huge swings in inventory from time period to time period. How many, and then, you know, if you cancel a lot of orders on the seller side, that's a negative. So all of these really operational metrics that, you know, maybe, if, you know, a traditional, you know, traditionally, maybe a CMO doesn't necessarily have to pay attention to that, because it impacts your performance so highly on these marketplaces. I think these become important metrics that everybody has to pay attention to.
Go on, Mark.
I was going to say, on your own site, that you'll create a bad customer experience, and the customers may not come as fast. But you're not going to shut down your own site because you had some issues. But you could get shut down on a marketplace because you have these issues. So super important.
Definitely. And it sounds like it's a huge amount to keep track of, particularly if, say, you were on multiple marketplaces. Like we were talking about hypothetically just the one marketplace to keep track of. If you got multiple marketplaces, say you're selling on eBay, Alibaba, Amazon, like all these different marketplaces, you're getting a lot of third party data there. Like, how can you keep track of and collect everything, like, so it's actually usable? Like, so you've got like a single source of truth with how things are performing on these different marketplaces.
By coincidence, that's what ChannelAdvisor does. So we have our platform, you know, helps our customers plug into multiple marketplaces and manage the product data out, you know, for consistency, and then manage the orders back in. So there's a, you know, seamless order process with the orders flowing in and then flowing over to the warehouses and whatever else you need to fulfill. So otherwise, yes, it can be pretty complicated to track all of that. And I don't know how you do it if you were interfacing with every single one of them individually.
So let's talk about some of these data metrics that CMOs can actually move the needle on. Like, what kind of effect can marketers have on, say, return rates or product defects? Like, what kind of things can the CMOs do to, is it just about manage expectations when it comes to that kind of thing with the kind of copy you're writing, the content you're writing, or is there more that marketers can be doing?
I think some is working with other teams when you identify a problem, and then some does come down to content. I had another example. So I use marketplace as an example, but you know, maybe I have another example that can try to answer that question a little bit. And so let's say you're a brand and you're selling through indirect channels. You have a retail set of channels. Again, sales, margins, kind of the top level metrics are super important. But once you get below that, to your question, what might be impacting performance on those sites, on any given retail site? And, you know, there's something called brand analytics or digital shelf analytics that help figure out what's happening on those sites and then give you a few clues as to what you can maybe do to fix the problems. These things can impact both your visibility on the sites and your conversion rates. And so the most basic data point is whether your products are even in stock on a retail site. And it's so basic, it's almost not worth saying. You know, it's kind of laughable, like, right, of course, you know, if your product's not there, you're not going to sell it. But monitoring that product availability over time is important. So you can figure out with your retail partners which ones maybe have issues keeping your products in stock. And that could be something on your side. It could be, you know, with your channel people, maybe having a problem with that retail. It could be something on the retailer side. And with that metric, that's all about maybe working with other teams to figure out, hey, what's going on with this retailer? Why is my catalog in and out of stock? So that's one example of maybe working, you know, outside of marketing. Closely related to that is what's your catalog or what's your assortment on a retail site compared to your competition? So that can influence, you know, maybe the perception of how big your brand is on any given retailer. The next thing from a visibility perspective, and this is where maybe marketing has a little bit more control, working with the retailers, is where do your products appear in search results? So this is important to monitor, you know, your key category search terms, your key product search terms. When a consumer does that, where do you show up? As we know, if you're not on that first page, you lose about 80% of the people that aren't going to scroll through your page three to find, you know, to find your item. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a clue as to okay, why am I not on the first page? That, you know, that just monitoring the search tells you where do you have a problem with certain products. And, you know, obviously we just talked about, you know, defect rates and all this stuff at Amazon. Those operational metrics may still be important, but in this case, the retailer is maybe taking care of that for you. So then it comes down to maybe more, you know, maybe the content, as you just mentioned. So if you're not appearing near the top, what are some possible causes? And again, most retailers don't publish their algorithms for everybody to see, so they're not gamed. But there are, you know, there are basic things. So your titles, you know, do they include your key search terms or key, you know, key terms for that type of product? Is your brand in the title? Do you have images, you know, for your products? How many images do you have? Is there other critical information that is used in those retailer search algorithms? For example, you know, just thinking about Amazon or Marketplace or something, you can get into a category, and then, you know, on Amazon, there's all these filters on the left-hand side, and you can click your way through the filters and it narrows down the product list. Well, in order for those filters to be effective, a lot of times you have to, as a brand or a seller, you have to submit that data to the marketplace so the filters work. If you're not submitting that data, the consumer uses those filters and you're not going to show up in the results. So, you know, getting that data right over to the retailer, over to the marketplace is step one. And then once it's there, monitoring those retailers to figure out with that content, you know, what might be missing. So I talked about titles, I talked about images. The other important thing is, you know, are the key terms in there, or the key, you know, product details. So when the consumer does get in there, they can see the full picture of what am I getting with this products. So that content is important for the SEO aspect on the retail site, but also to ensure that, you know, your brand is being represented consistently and you're providing consumers with an optimal experience. And that can also affect conversion rates. So, you know, you just mentioned, okay, maybe a product's not selling or a product's getting returned a lot. Why is it getting returned a lot? Well, maybe there's an expectation that I didn't make clear in the copy, you know, in the content I gave to my retailer that said like this product includes this or does not include this. And so the consumer had no idea when they read that description that, you know, this was or was not going to be the case. So that's important from that consumer experience point of view.
I was about to say, as well with the post-sale as well, reviews have got to be very important in terms of how you rank on the search pages on marketplace as well. Like if you're getting lots of 5-star reviews on Amazon, for example, you're going to be ranking higher in that respect, I'd assume. I mean, I'm not an expert on the algorithms of Amazon, yeah, but that's what I would assume from like basically how search engines work.
Yeah, absolutely. Reviews are super important. And you talk about the algorithms. Also, there's filters. You know, if you're at the top of a marketplace, you can select, show me the highest rated.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do that. And boom, if your reviews are good, you'll come up at the top. And, you know, reviews are also important on retail sites. And even if they don't impact the ranking on the site, which they do in some cases, but let's say they don't, it's still important because it helps the consumer feel good about the purchase, or it helps the consumer decide whether they want to even purchase this item. So we actually asked about reviews in our survey that I mentioned before, and I have a couple numbers here. 86% of the respondents indicated that reviews helped them choose which products to buy. So that's no surprise because we all do it. 66% said they may hesitate to make a purchase of a product without any reviews. So a lot of people maybe don't want to be the first person purchasing this thing. They want to see what other people have said. And then 83% said that reading negative reviews could cause them to abandon a purchase. You know, I think we have to be careful with that one, though, because I've also seen research. This wasn't in our research, but I've seen research that says if you see somebody with, you know, 70 reviews, I'm making the number up, and they're all 5-star, then you start doubting, like, is this real? Was this guy sending it to all his friends? And so a few negative reviews don't hurt, you know, you just don't want the dramatically negative reviews, and I think maybe this is what this 83% number is. If you see something that's terrible, like I bought this for my kid and ended up in the hospital, you know, because it broke and it stabbed them in the elbow or something. You know, you don't want to see something like that in the review. Yeah. But yeah, reviews are super important. Totally. And then probably the only other thing I'll mention is obviously pricing. I mentioned that before, but tracking that price over time is also good to see. You know, bad pricing or incorrect pricing will definitely impact sales. And so really all of this, you know, the content, the position in search, the availability, the pricing, the overall goal is to make sure your product's available, they're priced correctly, the consumers, you know, you're looking your best in front of consumers and therefore hopefully landing near the top of the search results and converting people that are clicking in to buy. And when you have a problem, it could be on your side with the content and you go back and you fix that. It could be a product problem. You go work with your product management team. It could be, I've given all this to the retailer and they're not representing my product the right way. So then you go work with the channels and you figure out, okay, how can my titles get better? I've given you 6 images. You're only using 1, you know, so there's lots of levers you can pull with this data on the retail side to try to improve your performance through those indirect channels too.
Fantastic. So we've kind of given a good like lay of the land of where things are now with e-commerce. Let's talk about the future. And to talk about that, we're going to kind of wind things back to when you were talking about the discovery phase, because historically, within the last like 20 years, e-commerce has very much relied on third-party cookies to place ads in the right places. Mm-hmm. With that ending this year, with Google getting rid of third-party cookies, is that going to completely change how people approach e-commerce marketing? Or is there some kind of comfortable workarounds to get there? Are we still going to be able to target people in similar ways? Well, obviously not in the same ways. Are we going to be able to do the same kind of detailed targeting with the data available without that kind of third-party data source?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's definitely causing a lot of change in the industry. And I think 2021, the big news was Apple. You know, Apple put in their app tracking transparency, mm-hmm. and turned it in from an opt-out, which, you know, you had to dig in through all the settings and opt out of being tracked. And now for each app, they put it right in your face and say, you want this app to track you. And so that was the big news there. And I think Facebook even said in 2022, that could have an impact of up to $10 billion in ad revenue. And there are anecdotal stories about, you know, smaller upcoming brands that were heavily dependent on Facebook in that audience, that detailed audience data to target their potential customers. And so, you know, that's definitely having an impact. And you mentioned Google. I think Google's moving in that direction on their mobile platforms as well. And then they're also looking at the third party cookies. Google is being a little bit more deliberate, I think, than Apple was. And some of these things are rolling out over time, and they're working with their advertising ecosystem to try to make sure everybody can win over the long run. So I think, you know, there's definitely lots of techniques that people are these companies are developing. And I'm not an expert in all of them, but, you know, essentially trying to give you audience data without getting all the way down to a specific person. So grouping individuals into, hey, these groups have all, you know, recently searched for baby products or looking for sporting, you know, exercise equipment. So I think those will, you know, end up being some of the solutions. The other thing is there's a bigger emphasis on first party data. So the platforms that own their data, which is the first party data, haven't really been impacted. So Google, from a search perspective, you know, Google owns all that data and they can give you a lot of feedback. So that probably hasn't, you know, if you're doing search advertising on Google, a lot of these changes probably haven't impacted you too much. And then Amazon's the same way. So Amazon has a huge advertising business that's growing super fast. And because of that, and because of the big network they have, they have so much first party data on everybody. They can serve super relevant ads. And there's a lot of different formats now on Amazon where brands can get in there and do lots of different, you know, good things. We see a lot of other retailers also creating advertising programs on the back of watching Amazon grow a huge, you know, revenue stream from advertising. A lot of retailers are saying, hey, we can do this too. And because, you know, we have all this consumer data, you know, we have all this first party data too. So we can actually serve super relevant ads to consumers on our site. So more and more brands, you know, we have a lot of our brand customers taking advantage of these retail advertising opportunities. So I think this retail media growth is being partly driven by some of the privacy changes, so we can get that first party data. We also see a lot of brands really focused on building out their own first party data. The buzzword there is customer data platform, or CDP, which is, you know, trying to track both known and unknown customers and prospects. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of experimentation with, you know, newsletters and promotions and incentives to get consumers to register directly with the brands. They can build up their own database and not necessarily have to rely as much on third parties, which may or may not be as accurate as they were in the past. But I think, you know, long and short of it is there's a lot of money involved in advertising. There's a lot of big companies involved. There's a lot of smart people involved, you know, smarter than I'll ever be. And so it's a problem that will be solved in one way, shape, or form. It may not work exactly the way it did before, but I'm confident that over time there'll be some kind of solution that allows, you know, marketing and advertising groups to spend money with confidence that they're getting some type of ROI out of that spend.
Excellent. It's good to know it's not the complete apocalypse that I read in some of the think pieces on this. That's a nice bit of reassurance there. This has been awesome, Mike. Thank you very much. Let's tie everything together. What are the golden rules of e-commerce in terms of utilizing data for e-commerce right now? Like, what are your big pieces of advice that you want to hand out to our audience?
Yeah. If I had a golden rule, I'd probably, you know, I'd probably have a book and be on a speaking tour and have all kinds of
still time, Mike. Still time.
So, but you know, I think there's some guidelines to follow, and certainly every business is a little bit different, and not everything applies to everybody. You know, but as we've talked, I think, you know, the e-commerce is big, and it's maybe not going to be as big as everybody thought in second quarter of 2020, but it's growing and it's going to keep growing. And, you know, especially as, you know, the younger generations now know nothing different than being online. And so there's no doubt it's just going to keep growing. So I think by this point, everybody has that message. And, you know, there's nobody that's, I should say, not many that aren't online and fully committed to that anymore. But once you are online, then, you know, I think one of the rules that we talk about all the time is, hey, your consumers, whether that be B2C or if you're B2B, I mean, small businesses are just like consumers. Mm-hmm. They're all online and they're not all in one place. They're all over the place looking for, potentially looking for your products. So, you know, as a business, you understand your target market, you understand your customer demographic. Where are those people online? Let's go meet them where they are and make sure they're aware of, you know, of your products. In doing that, that creates complexity, as we talked about. You know, you need to make sure your offer and your brand is consistent across all of those channels. You need to make sure your product data is consistent. And then you need to monitor those channels to see if they're working. And so the basics are the revenue, the cost, you know, am I making money? But then a layer deeper is really then how do you move the levers to make those things go? And that's where, you know, we talked about on marketplaces. It's really paying attention to those operational metrics to make sure you don't run afoul of all the rules, you know, that those big guys set, so they can provide the customer experience they want for their customers. So those operational metrics are important. And then, you know, when you're working through partners, paying attention to, you know, how your brand looks and monitoring that and tracking it over time and comparing it to the competition through, you know, brand analytics or digital shelf analytics. Because that lets you then identify, okay, where are the potential problems? Who do I need to work with to solve the problems? What are the problems I can work, you know, directly with a retailer to solve? So, you know, there's a lot of things to pay attention to. And each channel is a little bit specific, you know, where the data that is important. But it's, you know, you got to pay attention. You got to pay attention to those metrics to have success.
Sure, for sure. Well, that's a great note to end on there, Mike. Thank you very much for joining us today. I'm sure our audience has found it very useful. As we said, e-commerce is not going anywhere anytime soon. So I think pretty much any CMO in any industry has got to be thinking about some kind of e-commerce kind of structures for businesses these days. Thank you very much to listening to us today. I'm sure you've found it very useful. We'll be back soon with some more CMO Convos.
Thanks, Will.